This podcast is supported by Siemens, your partner for industrial-grade AI.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of our Industrial AI podcast. My name is Robert Weber, and it's a pleasure to talk to
Peter Sieber. Good morning, Robert. Good morning, afternoon, evening to all of you, dear listeners, wherever you are.
Good morning, Peter.
Robert.
Greetings from Istanbul.
I was going to say, you're traveling. Have you been looking at what, the Blue Mosque, or what I, as I recall?
Yeah, the Blue Mosque. It's very impressive. Yeah. We went there yesterday, and it's very sunny. 19 degrees, So it's very nice. A little bit of wind. So I'm sitting here outside of my hotel, looking from my balcony to the Bosporus and recording an episode with you.
The Bosporus, that's exactly what I thought of. So the last time I was there, must have been, 20 years ago. Whatever I talk about is always 20 or 30 years ago. And I was working. I was working for for Turkish Airlines. Yeah, I do recall that. I think it was in Istanbul. Yeah, and they had their head office there, and we were recording. I was with a mainframe company actually at that time. Yeah. They still existed at that time. I do recall it was a very, very nice time. And you say Bosporus. I was looking for the name of the river and the bridge over the river. And this bridge is actually the bridge between West and East, right?
Europe and Asia, right?
Europe and Asia, right.
And you can take a zip line and you can zip between Europe and Asia. We will do that today.
Oh, right. How do you do that? With a what kind of?
With a zip line.
A zip line.
It's a zip line. You have there's a line, and then you put something on the line, and then you have a zip, and then you go through the from the one side to the other,
like a cable connection, or
like a cable connection. Oh, but it's very funny. I think the kids will like it.
Okay, sounds great.
So let's talk a little bit about AI, not about tourism.
Yeah,
we can
do
a tourism podcast.
you can do the touristic part. Let me start with two weird words. The first is SaaSpocalypse, or the other term used here is the SaaSmageddon. I'm not sure. Okay. You heard of them. You can add your piece. So what they really stand for is SaaS, or Software as a Service, Apocalypse, or Armageddon, right? So we all know, we've all gotten used to SaaS, cloud-based applications, so accessing applications through a browser, typically paid monthly, yearly. We all do it, right? Salesforce, CRM, Google Docs, Microsoft, Adobe, whatever. Now, what happened is that Anthropic, they launched, that's already a month ago, Claude Cowork. So that's a workplace AI tool. It can read files, draft documents, organize workflow, etc. But then 2 weeks ago, they followed up and they introduced plugins, very specific plugins, let's say tools that are capable of specifically doing things in these market segments, finance, legal, sales, marketing, customer support.
Exactly.
So on top of the typical SaaS applications. Now, what happened is, and I was looking for the quote, but I'm not sure who was saying, but there was like a $285 billion stock market sell-off the day that
the
happened.
Tech.
That's what they called SaaSpocalypse, SaaSmageddon. Now, why are we talking about it? At that time, hardest hit were the companies, of course. Today, the SaaS companies in that area, Thomson Reuters, LegalZoom, Salesforce, etc. Why is that happening? Because, you know, the people who know about what's happening in the market, I mean, including us, people listening to us, and then people trading, they see what is happening that, you know, instead of us users managing, let's say an example, managing our customer relationship, CRM, you know, we want to use or hire agents. And today is, again, of course, a lot about agents. And we want him to close tickets or transactions. And in the end, we want to pay them outcome-based rather than monthly. You know, I want to get something back. So that's kind of what's happening, I believe. Now, and the only thing, and then why are we talking about it? It's like, you know, we need to consider, is as in general, always, we always look at things happening within the AI space and how can you, dear listener, how can you use this information for what's happening? But there was a very specific one already, and maybe you know about a second one that you want to share. But there is one that is related actually to what was happening in the PLM market. So one company called Dassault Systèmes, they dropped 21%. Now, I think one reason was that they had not been delivering in Q4. But on top of it came this, you know, AI narrative. Now, I think, and I don't want to go too far, I'm not saying that, you know, companies like Anthropic, OpenAI, you know, the, sort of the general large language model providers, that they will take over the industrial, in this case, PLM offerings from Dassault, Siemens, PTC, and all the other ones. Because they have, like, you know, multi-billion years of very deep knowledge. But it is important that we see that at least, let's say, the outer range, so where maybe the cloud co-work, and that's a term I come to later as well, when it's about writing reports, summarizing change requests, drafting compliance documentation, that's what they can do today already. So they start to move into the market in which we, industrial AI, are in today as well.
But this is interesting because then the big players like Dassault, Siemens, etc., they need to find another sweet spot, right? So what is there?
All of them, yeah, exactly, exactly. All of them. So moving back one step, the Salesforce and all the other ones, they have to. I think there was this discussion about the vertical horizontal SaaS. That was exactly spot on in the direction where you were saying. So whatever we call then horizontal or vertical. Yeah, finding the sweet spot, or the term that's always being used is this moat. Moat is, I think, is that the water around a castle in the past, in the medieval space. Maybe that's what you see today as a tourist. I don't know if you have that in the area of Istanbul. But what is the moat of these companies? Because the general large language providers are eating into, are kind of breaking up the moat. You know, they come from outside, they let the water out, and then, you know, they're going to come close to the castle and break down the stone, so to say. So, yeah, and I don't have a, and that's, as you say, you know, all of us need to be looking for what does it mean to what it is that we offer, and how do we maybe need to change our offering.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I want to come back because you mentioned agents. And do you know Peter Steinberger?
Yeah, exactly. That's my next topic. But you start. I'll just add. I spent almost 4 or 5 hours yesterday.
Yeah, okay.
You start.
Yeah, okay. Because Peter is not Peter Seeberg, Peter Steinberger.
Yeah.
He's from Austria. He's joining OpenAI to drive the next generation of personal agents.
Oh.
And Sam wrote, he is a genius with a lot of amazing ideas about the future of very smart agents interacting with each other to do very useful things for people. We expect this become core to our product offerings. OpenClaw will live in a foundation as an open source project, and OpenAI will continue to support. The future is going to be extremely multi-agent, and it's important to use support open source as part of that. So
that says it all. When did you read that? Now, it's important for you, listener, whenever you're hearing this, you may have heard of it, of course, in the meantime, but we are now recording Monday, a couple of days before we go live. So, and that's why I say it, because yesterday I spent a couple of hours, and even this morning as well, and I'll share.
So what is your opinion?
Well, no, and the first question then is, when I didn't know it yet, what you tell me now. So did you already hear this yesterday on the Sun?
I woke up this morning and I saw that in my stream.
I thought I was going to look for it later on. I didn't find the time. Yeah, so I looked at a couple of interviews with Peter yesterday. And yesterday he was saying, yes, he was still talking to Meta.
Yep.
to the Meta guy. What's his name?
Zuckerberg.
Yeah, exactly. What's his first name? Zuckerberg.
Mark.
Oh, yeah, Mark. He was talking to Mark. That was a very nice story. He said he was talking to Mark on WhatsApp, and then Mark said, "Yeah, we can talk now." But Mark was coding. It was very interesting. And the other story he did was exactly with Sam. Because what Peter has been doing, he has this thing called OpenClaw. Today it's called OpenClaw. Yeah. It started a couple of months back. It was ClawBot, MaltBot. It's not MaltBook. That's another thing. It's a little bit confusing, all the stuff. And the ClawBot was then too close to Claude, and so I had to change it. It's so interesting. In the end, what it is, in his words, it's an AI that does things. So you communicate it with through a messaging platform, WhatsApp, Telegram, Slack, whatever you want to use, and then you connect to an external LLM, Claude, DeepSeek, or any of the OpenAI. Now, and then in the end, I was going to say, and we put it in the front because you already know, we now know that he's going to join. Is that the way that was put by Sam? So OpenAI. And then he did a call to Sam maybe a couple of days back, when he came up with the latest name, which was then OpenClaw, which a little bit sounds like OpenAI. Yeah, exactly. And then Sam said, "Oh, what? Spell it to me, please." And Sam said, "Oh, yeah, that's okay." So it's interesting to hear. Now, why is this going to be big? Well, now it's probably even going to be bigger, I guess. What I just heard you say is that it's going to continue to be an open source project. That's what Peter was saying. That's very, very important to him. So you connect through your, let's say, WhatsApp or any other. It's local.
Exactly.
That's very, very important. So you decide yourself how much information you're going to share. Now, let's see how then OpenAI is going to be dealing with exactly this information. So I think it's important to say that you need some base coding capabilities. You start with some kind of pip install for those people. Coding, that's a standard thing. If you're not coding, that's still too early for you. You need to be careful. There is still some general security issues which Peter will work on, which then I guess together with OpenAI, and they are more general. They're not specific to him. But it's been amazing what's been happening around Peter, right?
Exactly. It's a little bit of hype too, right?
I've heard like, was it 24 was the OpenAI, the ChatGPT, was it 24? Then came 25 was the DeepSeek. And I've heard it say, and 26, it's a bit early. Maybe there's going to be even bigger things. But 26 is going to be the open claw moment.
From your point of view, what does OpenClaw means for industrial applications?
Yeah, right. And that's exactly the thought important for us. So if we say what it does do today, it does millions of things, whatever you want. It does your email, it creates your calendar, it checks your flights, whatever. It does do home automation. It's all that. There's only like 10 ideas that Peter shares
home
what's happening.
Yeah.
If you want to have your Tesla, you know, moved in front of your door, that's what all these things that we've always been talking about as a personal assistant.
Yeah.
I think that's the way to look at it. And his words, as I said.
As concierge service in the hotel.
Sure. Yeah, we all are going to have our personal assistant. Yes, right. In the past, it was the concierge for the people who couldn't afford it. In the future, we're all going to have it's a personal assistant. That's my word. Peter's word says the AI that does things. And because it does things, there is this potential. Now, it's check you in for your flights, home automation, and that's where you go. It's doing home automation today. Now, let's leave the home out. Will it be doing automation? Sure, it will be. Now, if and then, of course, we already talked about the security. In automation, as we talk about industrial, there can be zero. You know, we talk about industrial, great. And we always think of Boris Schauringer, who came up with that terminology, which is 99.9999, you know, security. We can't have any security potential. So, Is it going to be used in our world? I expect so. Yes, I can't say more.
So
than
the
that.
Concept, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. And is it only going to be this one? The very fact, I mean, I have not been in all these discussions on...
But why do not we see something like from the big automation players, some multi-agent industrial framework?
Well, let's keep the industrial outside. Why did not we see exactly this level solution from OpenAI, from Meta, from Google, from AWS, from the big players? Why must it be that now we just learned that Sam is going to put whatever, I assume a couple of hundred million, but I have no idea, is going to put big money into what this guy, this Peter, almost by himself, has been bringing together. And at the same time, he is being almost not accused, but people are saying, you're doing nothing new. And he says, yeah, it's all there. All the messaging services have been there. Of those, you and I, we use Slack, for example. We use WhatsApp. But there's many, many more. All the external LLMs are there. And he's been programming those interfaces, basically. And that's what he says. Yes, I didn't do anything more than that. He seems to be just a real smart cookie. Like there's many smart cookies, including, you know, those of you listening. But that's my understanding what he's been doing. And he was kind of, when he talks about what he's been doing, he was kind of impressed himself.
Surprised.
And he said, oh, and suddenly it started answering. And I thought, how can that be? I think he said he was in Marrakesh, yeah. And he was communicating through WhatsApp because he didn't have the broadband connection for other services. And then his solution, whatever it was called at that time, came back with something very smart. And he was kind of perplexed. What have I been doing, kind of thing. Yeah, it's amazing. I guess important is that today, as I said, you need some base understanding, coding, installing capabilities. But if now we know that this project is going to be part of OpenAI, I assume that means that at some point in time, I guess within the next couple of months, whatever, they are going to make it at the level that you and I as consumers and that our colleagues listening, making the industrial AI solutions are going to say, or maybe you listening will already be doing that today, but I'm sure you're going to be doing that on your, yes, local PC that is not connected right to start, or I've not been using like a VPN as a VPS, like a virtual private server, which you will run it on. Until at some point in time, you're going to say, okay, now you're going to make a sandbox solution with an industrial environment with sensors and whatever. And is it going to be the only one? Who knows? No clue. But at the moment, the OpenClaw has the big drive.
Exactly. So let's move to the main part, Peter.
Quick mentioning only, you're going to be talking to Ferry Abulhassan, not today, but now then you should tell. I didn't want to just move on without this. We had this opening of an industrial AI cloud by German Telecom in Munich. That's just 10 days ago. I just wanted to mention it. 10,000 NVIDIA GPUs. So without the NVIDIA, they talk about a sovereign European AI or Germany stack with SAP.
With 10,000 is not so much, right?
But it's all relative. It's still, I think they said they doubled the, what is it? The industrial AI public capability on the German market. So, and I think you're going to be talking to the CEO of T-Systems in March, sometime in details.
Exactly. I think in March.
Yeah, sorry. So let's move on to the main section, as you say.
Yeah, the main section. So it's not about agents. It's a totally different perspective when it comes to AI. I talked to Stanislav from Molecules One. It's a startup in Poland. And Jakub Tomczak said, if you want to learn how the whole pharmaceutical industry, medical industry is working in the future, you should do an interview with Stanislav. It's very interesting approach, what they are doing, how to find new molecules, how they produce new molecules, really produce. And that's very interesting. And our industrial AI sector also means chemical, pharmaceutical. And it's quite interesting to learn something from this area, right?
I think when you first mentioned it, I asked, like, is it something similar like the Alpha Fold? And you said maybe that direction
with
the main difference, as you just mentioned, is like they produce. They do not just design, but they produce actually new molecules.
They produce, and he will share the whole, let's call it, supply chain from finding new molecules to produce new molecules. And it's very interesting.
Right. And I'm very much looking forward to. I was very bad in, is that called, that's not physics, it's called chemistry, I guess,
it's
right?
It's chemistry, right?
I was very, very bad. This is the worst I was in college, I guess, with chemistry. Nevertheless, I'm very much looking forward to listen, and specifically with the idea of, as we typically do, and as you mentioned, you know, how can we maybe then use similar approaches or just use the approach and then turn it in such a way that we say, oh, okay, if that's what we can use also in an industrial, or even already you are talking about the industrial setting. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Robert, have a great time in Istanbul. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. My name is Robert Weber, and it's a pleasure to talk to Stanislav from Warsaw. Stanislav, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
You're more than welcome. Before we start talking about pharmaceuticals, chemical companies, process industry, please introduce yourself briefly to the listeners.
Sure. Yeah, very happy to be here. Stan, co-founder, now CTO and chief scientist of Molecule One. So Molecule One is a company at the intersection of deep learning, chemistry, and drug discovery. And what we do mostly is we help others make medicines faster.
And what is your background?
Sure. So foremost, I am a scientist. So yeah, my overall kind of passion has been since beginning kind of the scientific discovery process. So I really am very interested in trying to contribute to automating it, which is now a big topic, especially with like from the perspective of deep learning. And that's my background, really. So I did PhD in the earlier days of deep learning, then postdoc at NYU, which was a lot of fun. Then something called more like a formal degree in Poland called habilitation. Yeah, in my scientific kind of part of my journey, I was fortunate to write a few highly cited works on the foundations of training of deep networks. But then I was at this crossroad, right? So I was after a postdoc and I was like, should I go work, I don't know, for big tech, continuing this direction? But I decided to go to Poland, to Warsaw, to lead Molecule One. So that was...
That's interesting. You have an AI background, not a background in chemistry, right?
That's true, yes. As you know, it was like very utterly accidental where I ended up. But yes, my background is not in chemistry. So folks at Molecule One are very patient at explaining and entertaining my questions about chemistry because, yeah, we do a lot of work at, you know, like frontier of chemistry and automation of chemistry.
You mentioned, is your field drug discovery? Is it the overall topic, right? Or am I wrong?
Right. So mostly what we do is we synthesize a small molecule. So any drug discovery project really starts with the question, oh, I need to make physically this molecule to test it for, you know, biological activity. So yes, this is our primary field. But, you know, Molecule One starts from this perspective that we really need to discover novel ways to make medicine. So we not only automate how you make molecules, which I can go into more details, right? But also discover kind of novel chemistry. And that's why it's really interesting to me because there is this aspect of automating scientific discovery, right?
There's also the topic generative, right? So to generate something new.
Right. So, so in drug discovery, I think the main thing to understand is that there is a very big gap between what you can make in the laboratory and what you want to make.
Exactly.
So your generative models can come up with all sorts of crazy designs and people, you know, do that, but all of them have to be made in the laboratory. So we have both generative models and, you know, discriminative models, generally AI, to tell what can be really made. And I think where the things are getting really exciting, we also kind of broaden what can be made. So if you make new discoveries in chemistry, then actually what is a hallucination and what is not, you know, it starts to be something you can, you know, expand, right? Like, because we expand the space of molecules you can make to close this gap between what you can make and what you want to make, right?
Exactly. We're coming back later there, I think, because I have one more question when it comes to your company. Is your startup, so your idea, your approach, in a way comparable to startup like Max Welling's CASP AI? So it's not CASP AI is working on new materials, you're working on drug discovery, but this is a new field in AI, or am I wrong?
Right, so CASP AI is in inorganic chemistry, so less drug discovery, more materials, right? We really focus on synthetic chemistry, organic chemistry. So things, you know, things of life, things made of carbon that, you know, can become medicines. And here in our case, which is not the case, I think at the moment at CASP, it might become, we have a very big physical component in that we have operating highly automated laboratory where we attempt the synthesis. It's actually very, I think, important strategically to have like this vertical integration, if you will, right? So you have both AI, then AI is trained on data from your platform, and then you kind of use the platform to solve your client's problem, and in the process of so generate data that you can then feed to train better models. So I think it's really a good kind of fit for this podcast in that sense, right? It's like industrial AI in the sense of really vertical integration of both digital and the physical.
Is that your USP from your point of view?
Right. So maybe taking a step back, right? Like what is Molecule One and stuff like that. So as I said, really the problem is that there is this gap between what you can make and what you want to make. I think this is like crucial starting point to understand. And I think we see that also with like ChatGPT in terms of like hallucinations. Like it's kind of similar, you know, people like models hallucinate molecules that we cannot make. And this is important because there is, from my perspective, a bit of a crisis in drug discovery in that the molecules that we design, they don't pass clinical trials. And one of the reasons often is attributed to the fact that those molecules, well, there's this gap, right? So for example, Mother Nature, let's say, when she is discovering medicines, right? So natural medicines, things you can find in plants and stuff like that, those are usually much more complex structurally than things you find FDA approves every year from small molecule drug discovery campaigns. So that's the part that you want to enable creativity. So like that's the overall goal. Now, we have went through three phases, and actually the company has been repeatedly at the frontier for the last 8 years. It's been operating for a while. First, we're a software company. So we're designing pathways using our software, using AI. That was actually the first deep learning based software for synthesis planning. But then we realized that to really address problems of our clients, we should also make the molecules. It's a bit like dog fooding. So like we decided that if we trust our design plans, we should also make them, right?
Sure. Eat your own dog food, yeah?
Exactly, right? So that's when we created Maria. So Maria is our synthesis platform and our main product.
Maria stands for, it's only the name, or is it an acronym for something?
Right, so Maria stands for Maria Skłodowska-Curie, or is named after Maria Skłodowska-Curie. So she was double laureate, Polish-born chemist. And kind of this name always reminds us that our goal is to not only automate chemistry, so the platform is for making molecules, but we want to not only automate making molecules, but also discover novel ways to make molecules. So that's our inspiration. So Maria is a microliter chemistry platform, and we can talk about this, but basically we make very tiny amounts of molecules, just in like more than enough even to do biochemical tests, right? So our kind of going to, I think, your question, which is, what do we do for clients? The typical workflow would be that, let's say, a drug discovery company has an idea for medicine, but needs to test, let's say, 500 different designs. Let's say those designs might have come from AI, right? Then what we do is we help design these 500 molecules such that we can make them with the platform.
How do you design, or how do you build these molecules?
That's very important. So the problem with, you know, like advances in AI have always been enabled or preceded by large data sets.
By scaling, yeah.
You know, it's like in biology, there has been PDB, in GPT, that's internet. In chemistry, there is no public source of data, which is very interesting. Like, it's a very unique field in this manner. So we have generated, let's say, internally using the platform, the largest, as far as I know, on the planet, microliter chemistry data set, meaning data sets of experiments about which molecules can be made and which cannot be. It's a classification problem. So we have trained models on the largest data set of this kind. And those models, classifiers that help us in the generative process of designing this library. And we can, in this way, achieve very high success rates and design interesting molecules. But really, it was a crazy bet. So it was 3 years ago, we decided, okay, we need to scale up data generation and kind of design from grounds up everything in the platform to enable scaling, when it was very weird in some sense. And now, 3 years later, fortunately, we are in a position where we have a data that can support our clients.
Can you explain in a few sentences, where did you get the data from?
Yes. So importantly, we have generated it, and that's very important. So we have designed the platform that it enables running, tens of thousands.
But you need a lot of domain-specific knowledge to generate molecule data, or am I wrong?
That's true. No, that's completely true. It was a very interdisciplinary effort, and many things in the platform have been designed together to enable generating large-scale data sets. So we have 300,000 over individual experiments, which in this area, that's, the largest of its kind. And it's, normally a chemist would do maybe 100 experiments or 100 to 1,000 yearly, right? And our platform does 10,000 weekly. And this discrepancy is not, let's say, magic. It is coming from to the design of the platform. In particular, we use very small volumes of liquid or volumes of experiments to drive down the cost of reagents. I guess a very specific example. So yes, indeed, that was a big effort to generate this data. And I think all fields that are in the broader sphere of industrial AI will go or have gone through this evolution of generating domain-specific, often generated in a vertically integrated company, data to then enable AI. Because generic AI in chemistry, is really good for ideating, designing overall ideas, but not very good if you want to I want to make this very specific molecule that no one has ever made on the planet, right? It's always a novel problem because there are just so many potential molecules.
That's very, very interesting. Can you please explain a little bit what kind of models or machine learning you're using in the back there?
Oh, yeah, of course. Basically, there are two kinds. There are models that can generate a reaction of any kind, in the sense they ideate how you can make a given product. So there are different reaction classes. So those are generative models. Those are models we started with. And this was actually interesting because when we started, it was the first deep learning based solution commercially for synthesis planning. And those models were hallucinating when there was no word for it. So it was an interesting moment. It was 2019 before ChatGPT. But we had the same issues with we had to have this discriminator that was helping.
So they went crazy.
Yes, and it was very important because when chemists sees a hallucination in the generated reaction, immediately loses interest in the platform because doesn't trust it. And still the trust issue in AI is a big topic, right? And then the second type of models, those that we more often train on our data, are discriminators. And simply put, they take in the whole experiment plan, meaning what reagents you will mix, at what temperature, at what reagents, and then they predict whether or not, at what efficiency, the reaction succeeds. It's a task that humans often have to do themselves, are pretty poor at it. Chemistry is very hard to predict outcomes of. But because we have very specific data to specifically our platform, we have models that are very robust and generalize very well in general because they have a very narrow task. We don't ask them to predict any chemistry. We ask them to predict chemistry of the kind that we have generated data for on our platform. So these two mainly models.
You already mentioned at the beginning that you also automate the process, right? Can you share a little bit more details when it comes to automation?
Oh, yes, of course. So we attempt synthesis through a process I would call that critical parts are automated and some parts are not automated, and we kind of go there. So one critical piece of making a molecule is mixing reagents, basically. It's in general, organic chemistry is not that far from cooking. I like to use this analogy. You know, it maybe sounds funny, but it's actually very accurate. You mix things, you know, making tea at wrong temperature will not be a very successful process, things of that sort. So what is automated is, in particular, reaction mixing. What's interesting about our approach is that we use commodity robots. So there are approaches to automation that go through very expensive, very big buildouts. You know, I'm talking $40 million, $200 million for the space equipment and things like that. Our laboratory is much cheaper, though I cannot share exactly how much cheaper, but it is much cheaper thanks to the fact.
Why?
Yeah, it's much cheaper because we, first of all, miniaturized everything in the sense that we do reactions in small scale, and then we kind of tuned the approach to be able to use cheap robots. So in particular, coming back to your question, the reaction mixing is automated through a robot that's very cheap, like a few $1,000s really, called Opentrons OT2, right? But it is, you know, fully automated and repeatable and high quality. Then another component after you mix reagents is to analyze the outcome of your experiment. And that part is also automated through auto-sampling, meaning taking automatically the outcome of the reaction from the vial and going through the machine, and then very importantly, analyzing it using proprietary data. What is not automated, though it will be in the future, is moving, let's say, plates and reagents between those two and other stations, right? So that's how we approach it. We have been all, you know, we are a startup, so we have been always solving the biggest problem, right? So where's the human time spent mostly? And it's not spent exactly at moving plate from place to place, but more like at, you know, analyzing results or performing reaction mixing and things of the sort.
Coming back to your AI models and your AI approach, that sounds very, let's say, on Earth, right? That sounds not like an alpha fold solution, big models, or am I wrong?
Yeah, I think this is a good way to put it. We have been in deep learning, you know, before it was this craze, and we kind of used the tool, you know, like very, very practically speaking. One place where we are increasingly see both use it and see potential is using LLMs for designing experiments, like, you know, research hypotheses. That's super exciting. And also I mentioned mostly deep learning models that we develop in-house. So there is a big role, of course, of using generic LLMs for overall company automation. So that's also worth keeping in mind. But yes, those are like, you know, not billion parameter models and trained, you know, on 300,000, let's say, reactions. So it's not like internet scale data set, of course.
Let's talk a little bit about limits. What are the limits of your technology, of your approach?
Well, in a way, it's not that easy to answer because right now, because we really see a lot of potential, just need to like scale up. Like right now, we have like kind of too many things to do. But yeah, of course, there are limitations.
Share three more ideas to scale up.
Yeah, but like to first maybe to your question about limitations. One thing which is worth mentioning and also I think illustrates better the company is that we work in this microliter scale or microliter chemistry. So just a second about it. So we usually perform reactions. And I think it might be interesting to the broader audience, even though it's a chemistry background, because it exemplifies something that I think also is the case with, like, let's say, manufacturing of chips and other industrial AI, where you have a process that's like extremely fragile. So in that case, we do reactions in 30 to 100 microliters, something like that, depends. Can go a bit above, can go below, but this is an amount of like a few drops of water, very small. Generally, like, again, depends, but like it's really, really small. And at this scale, predicting chemistry becomes even more difficult. Models are clearly better than humans. And because of that, you know, it's also a limitation in the sense that we need to really be careful about our setup and we really need to train those models and have this data. So one analogy that I think is really here helpful to think about is manufacturing of chips, right? So it really now became pretty crazy with, you know, nanometer scale, and they had to do a lot of like innovation around the process, but also it's the challenge, right? Because now there's like one company that does those machines, right? The one in Amsterdam or somewhere.
ASML, yeah.
Exactly, right? So it's also an issue when your process becomes really, really specialized. Of course, we are not like them, like they're, you know, way, way, way more advanced, but like this is this kind of direction, which I think is an interesting trend in industrial AI, that you have this platform, which is pretty specialized, And you need to take a very custom AI for it and very custom data, and that becomes your moat, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And where you want to scale in the future?
Right, like a few things. I mean, one thing I am personally excited, and not to just kind of bore you with the overall company strategy, is making big discoveries with the platform, right? So not only being, I mean, it's not only, it's like very important, but not limit to being a provider of molecules, but also being able to discover novel chemistry, novel ways to make molecules, like something you could publish, and then kind of working on that in partnership. So that's something we have been doing more of. We have some projects successful already in this category, some hopefully soon starting, some already in the process. One that is public that I can talk about is really, really interesting. So, and again, I think really kind of something that I think there will be more of both in our domain and overall in industrial AI is our partnership with a company called WR Grice. So no one has probably heard about it on the podcast, but this is basically the biggest manufacturer of compounds or like chemicals in the US. So very often, let's say, when you buy something at the pharmacy, there is a chance like they have made it or, you know, someone like them. And this is like super complex problem that now there is more movement to reshore to US and Europe. Like US and Europe have limited capacity to do this. And like most of production is in like China. And there is a trend to reverse that. And our collaboration with WR Grace is in particular about using our platform to discover novel ways to make important building blocks for certain category of drugs. So it's really exciting because we might be able to go beyond what is done through like merging AI with platform and like with amazing industrial partner. So we hope to do more of that. And I'm very excited about this because it really enables one to see the impact of the platform in a very immediate way. So that's one scale direction that I'm really hoping for this year to grow.
Coming back to your customers, how do you onboard your customers on the platform? What does the customer needs to do?
Right. So right now it is a bit like, I don't know if you know these forward deployed engineers in the sense that we do pretty custom work with clients. There is not like, you know, glass of pane software that you click and it just orders molecules. But we want to move in this direction, right? So right now it's more like we have a conversation with the partner. Let's say what he or she wants to synthesize as a library. So coming back to the simple workflow. And then we do maybe one or two or three back and forths, agree on the design, and then we can move it to like our platform for attempting synthesis. So mostly it's kind of like this, I would say. On the front of synthesis, then there are like these bigger partnerships. So those are, you know, like just projects. So this is like just working together. And then we have clients for our software for synthesis planning, where there is like basically no onboarding. It's really beautiful UI. You just go on and you're, you know, off to go.
We already talked about the outlook, but are you hiring? Are you looking for new guys joining your company?
Just at this moment, we have one position open, which is very interesting for business development person with chemistry background. In general, we are opening probably more positions in the second half of the year. So mostly right now, BD. But yeah, I mean, if we open these new partnerships and continue scaling, there is a ton of work. And in particular, I think now with LLMs and things like that, what we really need are these cross-disciplinary people who can think in different categories. Like you started saying that I don't have chemistry background, but, you know, to some extent, though, I think people in my company would laugh a bit here. To some extent, I was able to understand some of chemistry, right? And I think this is really important so we have, when we hire, we look for such people, right? That can both experts in some domain, but then can quickly learn other domains. I think this will be a trend in general in AI, that more such people are important as we attempt these bigger problems.
At the end, I have one question about Warsaw and Poland, because Mistral is coming to Warsaw, and there are a lot of investments in Poland and Czech Republic. So is there a new horizon in AI? Because a lot of talent is in Poland and Czech Republic and in mid-European than, let's say, compared to Paris or Amsterdam, where everybody is going now, or Zurich. Is maybe Poland the next big thing when it comes to AI, into an industrial AI, domain-specific AI?
Interesting. For sure, we have amazing talent, right? So, you know, I'm extremely kind of I'm amazed by what, you know, folks like 11 Labs have achieved. You know, OpenAI was co-founded by Polish people, or like Polish origin people. So the talent is amazing, and like this is a good question where it comes from.
Right? Maybe the background is very good, right? Because from my point of view, a lot of AI is mathematics at the end, right? So it's math, and the background in Poland is very strong when it comes to mathematics.
It is. I think that's part of it. Yeah, yeah, it's part of it. So do we become a hub? I don't know. I mean, there are things that hold us back which are interesting. So for example, in Poland, so I don't know, I'm just to Silicon Valley, people there can think much bigger, if I were to be honest, than in Poland, where, we see problems. And I think now it's a problem because now, you know, now we really also need to think bigger. Like, I think what we try to do at Molecule One, sometimes better, sometimes worse, is to try to merge these two cultures, to be ambitious in thinking but disciplined in like analyzing. And it's very, very difficult. Like, usually people fall on one or the other, right? I would say often there's people have hard time with me at the company because I propose something that usually doesn't make any sense, right? And then they have to kind of criticize it. But yeah, I think there are things that also hold back the region. So, you know, whether it becomes a hub is a good question. I don't attempt prediction, but I'm very excited for Poland and for the broader region, that's for sure.
Stanislav, it was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Pleasure is mine.